This is Rose Manabusin for the National Park Service, and I'm interviewing Cy O'Brien today as warrior seen by World War II veterans. Can you give me your full name?
Cyril, C-Y-R-I-L, Cyril O'Brien. They called me in the Marine Corps Obi.
And can you give me a place of residence?
And I live at 10004 Reddick Drive, R-E-D-D-I-C-K Drive in Silver Spring, Maryland, and I was a writer and a media representative for the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory just outside of Washington, D.C. until a year or so ago when I retired. I have been in the newspaper work most of the time, and in fact, even when I was working at Hopkins, I was still a representative for papers in New Jersey. And in fact, one of the reasons of my coming back to Guam, a secondary reason by all means, is to write for newspapers and magazines about what I see here. However, it's not my principal reason. My principal reason for returning was simply to see the battlegrounds and to see the landing beaches where I landed as a sergeant with the 1st Battalion of the 3rd Regiment of the 3rd Marine Division. Very near Attleloup Point. This is my third trip, and I'll be staying, as I did before, in the vicinity of a week. I was 21 when I joined the Marine Corps in 1942, in July, and I landed on Guam when I was 23, 2 years later. I was with as I mentioned, the 3rd Marine Division. And I had served before on Bougainville, in the Solomon Islands, north of Guadalcanal. And there I had been in the infantry. In fact, I was an infantry scout. And I was so good that I wonder if some of the poor Marines I was with are still there. Because I was brand new at it, and I had not much experience as a scout, but my first introduction to combat and
at Bougainville.
So therefore, when I came here, I had heard guns fired before, but however, I was a replacement on Bougainville. I didn't make the landing. So making a landing makes all the difference in the world. There was an awful lot of more fire. In fact, I remember the thing that probably the first impression I got of Guam was the night before the invasion. I was on a ship offshore, and the star shells were falling continually. And I could look out there and see these big black hills that would be illuminated, and they'd even throw silhouettes. And you'd see them, and then another star shell would pop, and all night the Navy shelling continued, and all night the star shells broke, and all night you looked at these big black hills which almost hypnotized you, and you thought, tomorrow I will be in there. It wasn't necessarily a sense of fear as it was excitement. There was no need to fear it because you knew you were going to have to do it. And everybody was excited. And I remember before we landed, they gave us a big meal at 3 a.m. or whatever it was. I think it was steak, and even then I couldn't eat steak at 3:00 a.m. And I know the chaplain gave us communion, and we went down. We got into these Amtraks, these mechanized vehicles that take you ashore. And I remember there was a corpsman with me, a very cheerful fellow with a big mustache, and he said, Obi, I'll see you on the beach. And unfortunately, a shell landed in his Amtrak, and I never saw him again. I thought he was killed. When I got ashore, there wasn't nearly the gunfire that I thought. I had been watching the beach, and it was erupting in geysers of flame and smoke. And just fiery pandemonium. But when I landed, there was only occasional rattle of a machine gun or fire here, a puff whoosh of a mortar here, but not the same fuss as it was before. I found out later the reason for that, that the gunfire apparently had kept the Japanese down, and the first few waves didn't get all that intense fire that came subsequently. Later, however, the din was unbearable. I remember trying to talk to somebody on Geneva Ridge. We had to move up the hill. Remember, we crossed these Weiss paddies and we're going up the hill. And the din was, I remember, the small arms was so great that you had to yell to someone that near you so mm-hmm. they could hear you. And what did I want to do? I had been in the infantry, as it were, a Marine, the line company on Bougainville, but now I was a Marine Corps combat correspondent. And what I wanted to do above all things was to write a story about these Marines and the first invasion I had ever seen or known. And I wanted to get every detail, but I'll be darned, every time I would sit down, we had a little typewriter, much, much bigger than your recording machine here, and thinner. Mm-hmm. And you could fit it on your knee for a desk, and you typed on that. And I remember rattling off the lead about the invasion of Guam by the Marines, and all of a sudden these confounded mortars would start to come in, and they were like, it wasn't a matter of being concerned about them, what you were worried about, they were interrupting what you wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And so you went, so you'd say, damn those mortars. And you'd go over, you didn't have time to dig a foxhole. There was a fellow over in the corner. And I said, you mind if I get in with your foxhole with you? And he said, okay, Obi. So I went back and I still didn't dig a foxhole. I still started to use the typewriter again. The mortars came again, I went over again. The third time he says, hey, Obi, you better dig your own foxhole. I was of course impressed by the defense of the Japanese. They were on top of that hill, and they were pouring everything at them. They were really defending themselves very well, and the Marines were just as tenacious as they were defensive. They were 100 yards or something from each other. In fact, the Marines were so close that the Jap, there wasn't 100 guys, but we were very close. The Marines were so close that in some cases the Japanese couldn't even throw the hand grenades. They used to roll them down the hill because if they threw them, they'd go too far. Mm-hmm. They were that close. So eventually, though, a group went up the side, and of course the history tells how they got them, and we laid a lot of artillery and fire in on them, and I went up a, later I went up and I visited the saw the Japanese defenses and it was that some of them were huddled they were dead, but you could see they were huddled in fear, like someone huddling out of the rain. A couple of them were. It must have been they huddled like that when the shells went off.
Do you remember how long it took to get the Cerrito Cliff area?
Able Company was, I believe, a day and a half before they could get over that, not 100 yards, 25, 30 yards. Mm-hmm. But it was all uphill. And that Able Company, which I was paying much attention to, took that long. It was the next day to go over that short period. However, of course, the other regiment, like the 9th, had gone, ran right through like a juggernaut. Mm-hmm. On the other part, but here they were stopped right on the beach by the Japanese. There was a poignant personal item in this. As I said, I had been in a line company, that 2nd Battalion. I was with EZ Company, 2nd Battalion, 3rd Marines. Right before we left for Guam, I was offered a job as a combat correspondent. In fact, I had been offered a commission to go back to the United States. And I was about to take it until I met a newspaper man who was a correspondent. And he told me there was an opening and they were going to Guam and didn't have time to get anybody from the States, and I had it if I wanted it. So I am a writer, so I wanted to be a writer. So I took the job. I was happy to take it. And they made me a correspondent. And I landed, as I say, here as a sergeant. The Marine Corps kept us all the correspondents as enlisted. They did it till they commissioned us after the war. They kept us enlisted because we have a better rapport with the men. If you went in there as a captain or lieutenant, you wouldn't have the same rapport. So I was with this fire team, this cracked fire team. And when I went, this Easy Company, 2nd Battalion, and the rest of the company, tried to assault that Chinita Ridge from the northwest, from the flank. Mm-hmm. I suppose facing it would be the flank. And they were chewed up. Everybody in the fire team that I had been with was killed. Had I been stayed, I very likely would have been killed with them, because it was the fire team and every one of them was killed. In fact, most of the squad was killed.
And what squad, what company
was
that?
The Easy Company, 2nd Battalion, 3rd Marines. So, and my other commanding officer, whose name, by the way, was also O'Brien, got to the top of Chinito and was killed as he reached the top of it. So, I think the intensity of that battle has been underplayed, at least in the United States, by historians. They made Guam appear as a battle of light resistance. This is what the earlier press reports had. This was very easy for the AP and UP or the other reporters who were sitting offshore and getting your reports from the Navy to report. But had they stood right here and seen that, they would certainly have never considered this an easy campaign. And it wasn't for that Able Company, which was practically wiped out halfway up the hill. Of course, my memory and most of my attention is glued to the Chinito Cliff, because this is where such an impression was made of me. Then subsequently, I stayed with the 1st Battalion, and we moved across the island. It wasn't an easy thing. In fact, there were such things as, I remember one night, which most anybody with this history will remember, that about the second night or so, this Japanese banzai attack, and struck parts of the 1st Battalion, which I was with. That I was saved only because I was separated from them by a ravine. They chose that side, the other side of the ravine, to come down, and not where I was. It was pandemonium, and the Japanese were throwing, as you probably know from history, that they were throwing charges into the tents and bayoneting people in their foxholes. And then it was, as a correspondent, I wasn't writing about the overall event of the regiment, the overall event of the battalion. I was writing about individual people. Private so-and-so, Corporal so-and-so. I was writing about them. So when an event occurred, I would go to that area. Mm-hmm. And interview the Marines right after the event had occurred. Sometimes I had to stay there, and of course we took part or was present at the fire, in a firefight when these things occurred, and just had to play low. Frequently, of course, you were still caught in mortar fire. Is that they never called me sergeant or captain or anything, they called me Obi. And you would write a story home. And one of these Marines would see you come by and say, "Hey, Obi," and he'd wave his hand with a newspaper clipping in it. And you'd go up, and there, across the front page of the paper in Peoria, Illinois, would be the story and a picture of this Marine. And the proudest thing about that is this. They say that the dispatches of the wire services, of course, told what was going on, and they told about MacArthur. But they said that the articles that we wrote as correspondents about people will be kept
for generations in family Bibles, and that's a really interesting thing to keep in mind. There were interesting individual stories. Remember, there was a Lieutenant Grillo from North Jersey. He stopped me and he said, Obie, he said, this is a miracle. My life was saved by almost a miracle. And I said, what was that? And he pulled out of his pocket a prayer book or a missal he had. And it was right in his pocket over his heart. Mm-hmm. And I'll be darned if it hadn't deflected a bullet. It was made of metal. It had a metal cover and it had deflected a bullet. There was another young fellow I was with one night, I remember, and there was an attack. And he said, oh my God, I've been hit. And he knew he felt, he had blood all over, and he was sticky and black, and he knew he'd been hurt badly. Yet later he found out he wasn't hit at all, because the blood that he smelled, that he had on his hand, smelled sweet and tasted sticky. And it wasn't what it was. It was a can of peaches he had on the foxhole. And a hand grenade broke it open and put all the juice all over him. Mm-hmm. And in the night, he thought he'd been hit, but he felt he was bleeding to death, and he couldn't find any wounds. Mm-hmm. The day after we took it, maybe the same day we took it, that afternoon, I went to the top of the hill. I was halfway up to the top of the hill where I knew the day before there had been a machine gun. Because we were going up with a group of correspondents, we thought, with a photographer. His name was Herb Ball. Herb Ball is from Tanzania, California. Mm-hmm. And Herb and I, as a photographer, worked as a team. When we saw Able Company trapped up there, we thought, I wonder could we get up where Able Company is? So we started to go up the hill with a wire team. We were moving halfway up the hill, and this machine gun opened up. You could see the little mists. Now, nobody sees a machine gun open up in the mist and lives if the machine gun's firing at them. It wasn't. The machine gun was firing at a Marine machine gun down the hill, and as someone explained to us later, the Marine and the Japanese machine gun were carrying out a kind of a duel over our heads. Yeah. And then a young fellow jumped up with a carbine, one of the fellows stupidly, and fired at the Japanese machine gun, which was about as far away as to cross the street. And I thought, oh, we're dead. And how would the machine gun pay no attention? The next day, we didn't bother going up, it was impossible. The fire was too intense, it would have been crazy. We could never have gotten Naval Company. So I went down to the bottom of the hill, and I found the captain of intelligence, who I was under intelligence for logistic purposes. And he said, Obie, this is my guy. He said, I got the report you were dead. So someone thought I was dead. I didn't think I was dead, too. The next day I went up the top of that hill. There I found a Japanese machine gun. It may have been the one I saw before. I found this all by myself. There was nobody with me. There were two Japanese beside it, and both of them had holes in their heads. Both of them had been shot. In between them was an unexploded American hand grenade. Never been fired. It was one of the green hand grenades and never been fired. Never went off. And right in front of them was a Marine. He was slouched over and a carbine across his lap, and his head had been smashed. His helmet had been smashed in by what may have been machine, what had been fired. So you could tell what occurred there. This Marine had thrown a hand grenade, and it was defective. And that's what cost him his life. And then he killed them with his pistol, with his carbine, and they in return killed him. It was a dramatic scene that I will never forget. And it was so fresh. It was the event couldn't have been more than 12 hours old.
It wasn't anybody that you knew?
No. I tried to find out who it was and never found out.
But I had one advantage that in combat and in the Marine Corps, a lot of people did not have. I, as a correspondent, could go literally anywhere I wanted to at any time. It's as long as I stayed in my assigned area, which is the first battalion. And the thing you should get to get me was these line Marines. Remember, it's true I'd been there where the firing was, but remember, I wasn't the guy who had to. I came up when the event had happened, or I learned what occurred. Mm-hmm. I wasn't the man who was standing there with these screaming Japanese coming at me. I'd learned about it the next day, and someone who told me a story yesterday was killed this day. And of course, the thing was, if you were alive, you were a big success. That's all you had to be. Was all, if you breathe and protect yourself, you know, you were a big success. I had to. You really get tremendous admiration. You get tremendous admiration for these people. We're facing, facing imminent death continually. The possibility of death was like they had almost as if. This is a certainty of being rained upon. That's how close it was, as if you were out in the rain. And although I wrote about it, and although I was with them, I still remember, did not have the same tension, did not have the same, I wasn't in the same jeopardy as the men who actually were there when these people screamed at them. The universality of people. I read these stories in other islands about the Japanese killed themselves afraid of these terrible Americans who would torture them. And the innate chivalry of the American, I remember this yet, the innate chivalry and respect for womankind has impressed me. We went back, I was on a patrol, we went back over this big heavy stream. So, something like a river. And we found these Japanese women in a cave. They were dainty little ladies. And, of course, nobody looked pretty after living in a cave with hair falling out. And I always remember when we got to the stream, these big Marines picked these women up and carried them across the water so they wouldn't get their feet. It was just innate chivalry for them to help these little ladies across the stream. Now these were the enemy Japanese, if you wanted to call them, mm-hmm. but the fact they were still women, and that respect came out. I was very much impressed by that. Shocked me was that you could never get used to seeing people with terrible wounds. That bothered me, to see other men hurt badly like that. But amazed I've seen them so badly hurt and torn up, and you wouldn't think they cut their finger. There was no, they were except for the shock of it. When I landed on Guam, I was going ashore and I found I had a slash or cut in my hand that was bleeding, and I thought, heavens, I'd better get something on this or it may get infected or something, it was altered. And so there was an aid station very close to me, and I went up to it. It was very close by, and I went to the aid station. When I went up to the aid station, I looked and I saw all these men that had been so badly hurt. I just put my hand in my pocket and didn't say anything. Just went away. Yes, about the people on Guam, I was very much impressed. The thing that impressed me was they were living in hovels under because their homes and everything had been destroyed. And I still remember living in holes in the ground practically. This is the first day. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't believe
seeing this young girl come out of from under the ground, and she looked as clean and fresh. Her clothes, I wondered how in heaven's name could this, the pride and self-respect that young lady had. You know, I would have said to hell with it. I wouldn't care if I had anything on me, but did you? I was impressed by that. Well, later, the first time I had ever tasted your red rice, we were on a patrol section here, and so eventually we put an outpost our way out. And one day, suddenly, out of thin air, in came a whole group of people from a nearby town. And right there on the spot, they cooked beef. They had the meat. They cooked beef for the whole group. It was about not quite company strength. And they cooked all the meal for us, gave us all, cut up all papaya, and then made us the red rice. And it's the first time I'd ever had red rice. And now every time I come back to Guam, we usually have a fiesta and we usually get the red rice. But it was the first time I'd ever seen it.
Was there anybody there that there was, personally?
Yeah, there was a young man. His name was Young Man. About 14. He had a carabao wagon. And they had only one speed, and that was slow. And he used to come by all the time. Occasionally he'd give us fruit, and well, we'd give him candy or canned goods or whatever it was, and we got to know him very well. Found out later that he and his father had operated a radio. They hit it in a wagon. We knew Japanese were here. I guess that would have been death if they were caught. And they had done that. Then there was a lady named Rose. I think her name was Torres, like Priscilla Torres, the girl in Saipan. And we used to go, she used to always do all our shirts. And she had it wasn't an electric iron, she had a heated iron on the stove. And boy, we used to go over wonderful for you to be able to get fresh, dyed shirts. And she knew that right here. Oh, it was a wonderful feeling. And I remember her very well, too. Go ahead. How do I feel about the Japanese? No, I don't have I don't have bitterness. I feel that they were young men. The ones I had contended, there were young men who were GIs and who had to stay here and do the same thing we did. Had I, however, as some other Marines did, had very close friends bayoneted or killed beside them, my feelings may have been completely different. But with my own experience, knowing them as just other soldiers, I don't have any bitterness. One day, an interesting story. I was asked to take a prisoner back from here to division, and we were going along, and a group of Marines got hit in a firefight, and they brought this wounded, bloody Marine out. And they took our Jeep from us, and they left me alone in the jungle with this Japanese. And I thought, my God, if a Marine see him, I'm dead. And so along came a Marine Corps truck that I was taking this Jap down back to the stockade. And the driver, I hitchhiked, and the driver stopped. And the Japanese, he didn't want to get away. He jumped on the back of the truck like I did, and the driver said, who's your buddy? He was... that he had been from Tokyo and grew up in the city and wanted to surrender. He didn't go for all that Bushido crap.
Did he speak English? Did he speak?
No,
English?
Okay, I had an interpreter with me. No. Okay. Okay. What would I like to see?
Before we get into the national park, could you give us a what you remember after you left Guam and where you went after you left Guam?
I remember about Guam? Okay. Okay, you can put it on.
Yeah, that's
I always, from the time I landed, I always felt close to Guam. I don't know if my landing, because I landed here, mm-hmm. I always had a soft spot for Guam. I always felt it was part of me. And I thought, there's no American on Guam that was 9 minutes before me here. Each way was 3 minutes, and I was, so that put me, theoretically, 9 minutes I here. So there was nobody here 9 minutes before me. So I thought, you know, so I felt somewhat possessive of Guam. I knew he'd come back. I just felt warm about it. I felt warm about the people. What I like about the people, I'll tell you. What I like about Guam. One, I like it. It's beautiful. Two, I feel close to it. Three, the people have always been warm. I never saw a sour grape yet, because maybe I never got in any trouble with anybody. But they're always very warm and receptive. And another very interesting thing too, they're not, you've seen places, places or other parts of the world where people just don't seem to give a damn, or they're, here everybody's so alert. You know, it's funny, the Americans, anywhere they go, and probably pick this up a little bit from the British. What is that Anglo-Saxon superiority that the British, the Americans really don't have that much, but the British had a lot of it. I came back here and I'm Guam or Saipan. There was a young Shamara girl. She spoke Carolan, English, Japanese, and Shamara. And she turned the languages off like you turn off lights. You know, God, that's a. I've been very much impressed by the people in the land. I just. Very much like Guam. Lovely man.
Did you follow the troops to Iwo Jima?
Oh, yes. I went to Iwo Jima then. I was with the 3rd. I landed with the 9th. No, I didn't land with the 9th Marines. I was with the 3rd Regiment, mm-hmm. which was never committed on Iwo Jima. And when I realized I wasn't getting committed, I started to scream and yell, and I got in touch with my commanding officer, who was ashore. And I said, get me ashore. I don't want to be just standing off the land. If I'm on this coast, I'll be damned. I want to get to it. And he pulled some strings and he got me ashore. And I joined the 9th Marines on Iwo Jima. And I had a chance then to, of course, a lot of the fighting was over by the time I got there. Mm-hmm. And
what was the terror like?
What's that?
What was the area like? The terror?
My first I landed in where everybody landed. Mm-hmm. On that ash, mm-hmm. which is at the base of Suribachi. That ash, very interestingly enough, you lived in the States, you know. If you ever burned coke, it looked just like coke. And porous looking thing. So. Mm-hmm. And then they moved us down to the southern part of the island where they were patrolling. And so I used to go out I'd do as much as all the Marines did as I could. I didn't get in the way. One night I was on an ambush. I always remember this, you know. I was on an ambush and they were waiting for the Japanese to come by. And all of a sudden everything lit up. Sparks and noise and guns and shatters and bang, bing. And they killed a number of the Japanese that caught in the ambush. All right. In the morning, I found heel marks. What occurred is, like heel marks that were left, something like a marks of a cart, of a wagon, like the tracks of a wagon, but there were heel marks. I'll tell you what. Someone had come in under our guns. Mm-hmm. A Japanese, taken a buddy, and dragged his body or his wound, his buddy, out from under our guns and took him away and lost him a field. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, that's a
That was really a courageous thing for him to do.
I remember that. Okay. Can you remember, buddy? Eugene was there's a lot of, all of my acquaintance with Eugene was, like, here, with the most intense was those first couple days, mm-hmm. the bonsai attacks, the attacks on the hill. But then, it got slower. As the Japanese were beaten, it got slower, and it got slower, and there'd be a firefight here, and then it'd be a long period of nothing in Tokyo. On Iwo Jima, the intensity of Chinita Ridge seemed to happen all the time. Mm-hmm. It was never stopped. It always was the same intense combat. It seemed to just never stop. But that's the difference in Iwo. It just seemed to be much more, the fighting seemed to be much more intense. Okay.
The war in the Pacific National Historical Park was commemorated to, for all people and all nations who participated in World War II. What would you like to see personally at the park?
First, let me tell you what I like about it.
As far as development.
What I like about it is that it's the most complete, centralized area of memorabilia and history of the war, including the uniformed Japanese soldier and the uniformed Marine with the weapons. There are things down there I recall, and I'm happy to see. However, the museum is an entity. You have done nothing to relate the museum to the hills that are right neighboring you. Mm-hmm. This, I can look right now out this window and see a hill where combat took place, right across the hill right over there. But there's nothing here that tells me that is so. I think the National Park Service has done a wonderful job. Of course, they've had 100 years to do it. At Gettysburg, Fredericksburg, and the other battlegrounds, they've outlined the battle scenes. They've delineated the units. They've told the progress of the battle, and it's simple for even a non-military person to get this whole picture. What I would like here, and I think anybody would like, would be to have a marker out on the road or in here. Maybe a bronze graphic depiction of the hills. So someone could stay here and look at these hills and then mark them out on the road and then point out in as simple a manner as you can where the landings took place, marking off the units, and then maybe something about what happened on day two, day three, day four. You wouldn't have to cover the whole battle. That could be done subsequently, but I think the battle for the beachhead should certainly be covered and made simple and graphic right here at this very spot. Here you could do it inside with it better. You could do it on a wall or on a wall map. But out there, you might put a marker, a bronze, put it in bronze or copper out there on the street, and then someone could come by and you say, you don't know how effective it would be. It's done already. Mm-hmm. It's done at Fredericksburg. It's done at Gettysburg. It's done at Bull Run or Manassas, depending on where you're from, and done very effectively. I'd like to see that. It would be great.
Is there anything that you would personally like to add?
Let's see. I would like to see a permanent, very obvious marker here, very much of the kind that you will see in the States. They are large and they're white with black letters. The Park Service puts them up, and they're everywhere in the States. And you can go by, and it'll say, here, General Braddock in 1767 did this. Why can't we have such a marker here? That people driving by, and you do have many visitors, would stop and see it and make it a tribute as well as a marker to the Marines who landed here, and I can look at the very hills where they lost their lives right now. Fine.
Okay. On behalf of the National Park Service, I'd like to thank you for your contribution to our history collection.
Thank you.